was an especially vivid flash of light. A specialist trooper team hefting a plasma cannon had begun to open fire. The brass thief lurched as it was hit, turned, and threw one of its rhyming swords at the weapon team. Tip first, the whistling blade tore through the plasma weapon's breech and impaled the chief operator. Its power pod ruptured, the plasma cannon exploded, incinerating the entire team in a boiling cloud of violet energy. The shockwave felled another dozen men nearby. A fragment of razor-sharp debris from the cannon's focus ring zinged out and sliced through the neck of a guard officer. Kalzean smiled.
Oh, tell him to bring that soul for my collection.
The remaining troopers had broken in terror and were running for their lives. The blazing wreck of the exploded cannon formed a white-hot pyre at the heart of the courtyard, the leaping flames reflected in the oil-dark lake of blood. Bodies and body parts lay everywhere. Nearly 40 men of the palace elite, butchered. The brass thief stepped forward, the firelight glinting off its blood-flecked armor. It bent down and picked up the piece of focus ring and hooked it around its belt. Then it held out its empty hand, and the rhyming sword it had thrown flew back into its grasp, plucked from the burning corpse. On the far side of the courtyard, Revoke pushed Trice behind him and turned to face the oncoming spectre of destruction.
"Taurus, old friend," Trice said. "Please, don't let it get me."
Revoke tried to reply, but his mouth was bleeding from the unword he had used to knock the demon down in the processional. That had been the only thing that had worked. Though it hurt and tore his throat, Revoke howled another unword. The advancing incunabula rocked back as if it had been hit in the chest by a tank round. Revoke could smell psychic powers suddenly. The trace had probably been there all along, but he'd been too busy to taste it. He reached out with his telepathy, not at the approaching demon, that would have been futile, but at the distant mind that guided it.
"Taurus!"
Yedetrice cried out. The brass thief was powering forward. Two more unwords, agonizingly voiced, slapped it back. Revoke's real counterattack was somewhere else. As he shouted the monster down, his mind was soaring elsewhere, into the dark, into the depths of the city. There, 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 some twitching lunk called Kina.
"Saul," Kalzean said.
Kina replied.
"Saul, disengage now. Right now."
Orfeo Kalzean tore his hand away from the orb to break contact. He had felt what was coming. A vengeful telepathic fury of hideous force struck Saul Kina like a hammer blow. He stroked out at once, his brain pulped. His eyes burst into flames. With a violent twitching fit, he toppled over, dead. Loosed, unguided suddenly, the incunabula staggered, off balance. It glared around the courtyard for a moment, the firelight dancing off its crested mask. Then it mewed pitifully, writhed and flew off into the night. Revoke turned and stared at his master. A huge tumult of panic and confusion rang from the palace behind them.
"Dear gods without a name," Yeda Trice murmured. "All that I owe you up to now, Taurus, is nothing. I owe you my life."
Blood was pouring from Taurus Revoke's mouth. His lips were split. He spat out gore onto the flagstones, and a shattered tooth came out with it.
"Just doing my job, Lord," he lisped.
Orfeo Kalzean caught the trigger orb as it fell from Kina's collapsing body. It was smoky hot.
"Shit," said Layla Slade.
"Indeed,"
Kalzean said. He seemed almost amused.
"What happened?"
Lezard asked.
"They bested us," Kalzean said. "I offer my apologies, Magus Clankula. I underestimated their resources."
"We have failed?"
Arthus asked.
"Tonight, yes, most probably. I am an expediter, Freighter Arthus. You employ me for my skills and my experience. Not only because I know what to do, but because I know what else to do when things don't go according to plan. This is just a setback. I'll ponder for a while and decide upon the next best course of action."
"A setback?" Arthus seemed contemptuous.
"Perhaps not even that," Kalzean said. "Have the freighters look to their mirrors. Examine the prospect and its determiners over the next day or so. It's possible that even without killing the chief provost, we might have derailed his involvement favorably."
What of your servant? Slifoy asked.
It is cut loose, wild. It will return here in a few hours and shut itself down. Make sure it's well fed, or it won't be willing to serve us the next time we employ it, and we will need another psyker. Someone very able. I'd like the Frattery to procure one this time, preferably someone from off-world. Bring them here.
Of course, said Lezard. Anything else, Ophiel?
Give me time to think, Magus.
Yes, but the prospect.
The prospect is the only thing that concerns me, Magus Clankula. 100%. I will make it happen.
Orfeo Kozian turned and walked up out of the basement, Layla Slade at his side.
I think we should leave, she whispered.
We are leaving, Lay.
I mean the planet. This is turning into a lousy deal. The Frattery might turn nasty if we don't deliver.
We will deliver. This is exactly why I choose to be in this game. It's so seldom a real challenge arises. This is the one, Lay. The expedition that will make my name immortal. Can't you feel it?
I feel something. Those frigging one-eyes glaring at us. I say we make our excuses and quit.
Layla Slade, that's hardly the backbone I hired you for.
She shrugged.
I'm hungry, Kalzian said. I need a decent meal and some distraction. Is it too late for the last show at the Carnivora?
I'll check.
Tomorrow I want a day without interruption, and I need you to look out some books for me, some old almanacs from my library. Anything you can find on the subject of Enuncia.
Yeah? What's that?
No one really knows anymore. Just a memory of a myth. But that man tonight, the one who kept our thief at bay. I'd stake my professional reputation on the fact that he was using it.
Chapter 11.
So how did this happen? Belknap asked, slowly packing the wound with sterile gauze and tissue cleaner.
I cut myself shaving, said Harlan Nail.
Right, said Belknap. There was I thinking this was a gross wound caused by a side-blown round on a tumble. Nail sat, stripped to the waist, on a wooden stool in the Spartan kitchen of Miseramus House. The doctor's practice bag was open on the table and the contents spread out. Kiss stood in the doorway, watching, Zale at her side. It was almost an hour past middle night, and the city outside was deathly quiet.
You know a lot about gunshot wounds, do you?
Nail said. I know a lot about a lot, mister. There, done. Keep it clean, and I'll check it in a day or two. Belknap looked at Kiss. Two, you said?
The other one's upstairs.
All right, then, show me. And just so we're clear, I'm not happy about this. Slaphead here is a moody class muscle, and you, I don't know what you are.
I can hear you, Nail said.
I don't care, Belknap replied. I'm doing this for Zale, okay? And in return, I'd like you people to do something for me.
What?
Asked Kiss. Let him go. Cut him loose. Give him a few hundred crowns. Your type probably has that in change. Send him on his way. Give him a chance. I mean, before this gang life of yours swallows him up.
Our type, Nail said.
Shut up, Harlan,
Kiss warned. She looked at the doctor.
This is not what you think.
It really isn't, Zale put in.
A rented house, a gunshot wound, serious muscle, the need for a backstreet sawbones. I'm not stupid, lady. This is connected syndicate stuff. You're in somewhere up to your ears. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're not wrong,
Kiss submitted.
We're up to our ears.
Show me the other one, Belknap said. They went upstairs. Patience.
Yes, Gideon.
We appreciate this Medicae's help, but can he be trusted?
Zale says he can.
The question stands.
All right. Call me a woman of simple instincts, but I reckon if you cut the doctor through the middle, you'd find the word trust written right through him.
Let's hope I don't have to ask you to do that.
Kiss led Belknap down the upper hallway, Zale trailing behind them.
How did you sucker him in? Belknap asked her.
Zale. Actually, we brought him along for his own good.
Your kind always says that.
Sometime soon,
Kiss said sweetly.
You and I are going to have a little talk about what you mean by that phrase.
She opened the door to Kara's bedroom.
Kara lay on the little cot, twitching and pale in her fever sleep. The bandages Nail had wrapped around her stomach were leaking blood.
"Oh, Throne," Belknap whispered. "What the hell's this now?"
He sat down beside Kara and undid the bandage.
"Blade wound. Hell."
He jerked back as droplets of blood billowed out of the cut in Kara's belly.
"God, Emperor, that's not normal. What did this?"
"It was something they called a vampire blade," Zale said. "They said it tasted her. The wound won't close. Please, Dr. Belknap, do something. Kara's too nice a lady to die."
"I don't even know,"
the doctor began. He rose to his feet and looked at Kiss and the boy.
"What is this? What the hell is this?"
I slid into the room, my chair hovering noiselessly. Belknap stared at me for a long moment. "My name is Gideon Ravener, Dr. Belknap," I transponded. "These people, Zale included, are my associates. I thank you for the help you have offered us so far. I understand you are scared, and also admirably concerned for Zale Affinity's welfare. I believe this might reassure you." I activated my chair's display mechanism. The slot opened, and the projector slid out, casting the hololithic image of my rosette. It was not the regular red sigil. I had adopted the azure mark of special condition, the grave, winged skull. Belknap recognized it all the same.
The Inquisition.
I am an Inquisitor, yes. Once of the Ordo Xenos Helican. Now in special condition operation here on Eustace Majoris.
The Inquisition,
Belknap repeated. These are members of my team, Doctor. We are here on a mission of the utmost gravity, and we are here in total secrecy. That's what special condition means. We cannot contact the authorities for help, not even medical help. That is why Patience and Zale came to find you.
This is all too much, Belknap stammered.
Too much for you, Doctor.
As I understand it, an Inquisitor carries with him the personal authority of the God Emperor himself,
Belknap said quietly, staring at me.
To disobey the orders of an Imperial Inquisitor is to disobey the voice of the Golden Throne itself.
Right. That about sums it up, I said.
Then I will not question you, and I will do everything you ask me to,
Belknap said simply. Save Kara's life, I said. He turned to work.
I have a salve, a certain tincture. I can arrest the blood loss for a while. Then, if I can run some tests, I might be able to counter the damage. But my resources... I'll need a transfuser, of course.
Whatever you need, Doctor, I said. We have funds. Tell Patience or Zale what you want, and they'll get it for you. I swung my chair round and faced Kiss. Your instinct was good.
I'm glad. I thought so, but...
Patience, I need to tell you something about Zale. Something Wistan found out tonight.
Crap. What's the kid done now?
It's not like that, Patience. It's about what he might do.
What do you mean?
I was about to reply when the Psi shockwave hit me. I was unprepared for the force of it, and it lurched me over. A huge cyclonic event had just boomed across the hive. I left the shell of my chair at once and went bodiless into the night above the house. I could hear Kiss's desperate calls echoing below me.
Gideon! Gideon!
I'm fine. Check the house security. I rose up free into the night sky, the vast city blazing below me. Traceries of bright sci-fire burned over the inner formals. Taking the ether form of a salmon, I swam down towards them and saw.
Throne. The blood.
The butchery. The dismemberment. The palace yard filled with dead, fire boiling from a ruined weapon. This was the diplomatic palace in Formal A, the heart of subsector power. Wholesale carnage had happened here. I read the dying fiber traces of a demon in the air. It was loose somewhere, a being so powerful I didn't want to find it. Something primeval, an atavistic throwback to the preformed ages of chaos, an incunabula. And there, hurrying for cover, there was certainly the chief provost, Yeda Trice, supported by another man in a dark suit. Attendants were rushing to them, medical teams spilling out into the horror of the courtyard. Alarm bells. What in the name of the God Emperor had just happened? The man in the dark suit looked round. He smelled me. He was a psyker, a very, very powerful psyker, and he had caught the scent of me on the wind. I couldn't allow that. I recoiled at once, pulling back. His mind snaked up after me. Whiston? Whiston Frauke put down his slate and deactivated his limiter. The world went dark. Somewhere, invisibly, the hunting mind of the man in the dark suit roamed on, thwarted.
Ravana? Kiss asked.
Get Thonius working. Get him to tap into the news vox and the ministry ciphers. Something just happened down at the diplomatic palace, and I want to know what it was. Now! Chapter 12. Even as it began, Maud Plighton decided it was going to be one of those days. She knew why, of course. The night before, the public data services had carried special announcements informing all Hive citizens of a grave incident at the diplomatic palace. They didn't specify what, but the PDF had gone to stand too, and the entrance to the Hive Heart formals was likely to be restricted, so it had to be something pretty big. Plighton lived in the spare room of her elderly uncle's townhab in Formal E, and usually travelled to work on the rail transit. She put in a call to the department to find out what was going on, but all she'd got had been a recorded vox message advising staff to expect delays on the transit network. So she'd borrowed her uncle's transport and driven into work instead. Uncle Valerin was getting on and pretty much housebound. He'd been a musician in his day, though mental infirmity meant the clavichord no longer sang under his fingers. But he'd been successful enough to accumulate modest wealth and afford a two-story townhab in an inner formal and a private nurse. Maud was his only living relative, and she'd come to live with him when she started her work with the magistratum. Valerin hadn't really approved of his niece's occupation, though nowadays he often couldn't remember what it was she did.
"Can I borrow the Bergman, Uncle Valley?"
she'd asked that morning, drinking a caff over the sink, clad in her full uniform. It was early still, dark outside, but her uncle had been up for hours, sitting at the spinet, as if wondering what the ebony keys were meant to do. He hadn't driven the Bergman since 89, when the administratum had cancelled his permit on health grounds. But he kept it garaged in the private bunkers under the hab block, and once in a while allowed Plighton to drive him out to the Stairtown parks on her day off.
"Are we going to the parks?" he asked.
"Not today, Valley, but I need to get into the A. Work. It's important."
He looked at her, in her full magistratum harness, body plate, helmet, hooked at her waist, and said,
"What is it you do, Maud?"
"I work, Valley. Can I use the Bergman?"
He shrugged.
"I suppose."
He turned away and started to plink at middle C. She let herself out quietly, taking the keys from the jar on the shelf above the hall heater. The Bergman Amity Velox was a 4-litre carbide coupe with slate-green bodywork and extravagant chrome. Plighton adored its leather and linseed smell, its rumbling undernote. On her salary, even allowing for promotion, she'd never afford a private transporter like the Bergman herself. The story went her uncle had been given it as a gift by a conductor who had been brought to tears by the way Valerin had played a particular work. As she drove up through the expressways and interlinks of the inner formals, the traffic grew denser. Thick clouds of acid fog had draped the streets with a yellow mist. She saw rail transit stations closed and guarded, and PDF detachments manning unshrouded weapons emplacements on the buttresses of high stacks. The Hive had armed itself. Regular roadblocks hemmed in the choking traffic, magistratum officers in rainslickers checking permits and idents. Plighton began to wonder if she'd have been better off staying at home. She began to wonder what the hell had happened at the diplomatic palace. She risked a downramp and used her knowledge of the sink-level street grid to pull ahead of the blocked arterials. At Wiscayne Circus, she took a surface ramp and tried to join the Formal A South Express. Another impasse. A vast multitude of administratum workers had attempted to meet the start of their shifts by walking in along the pavements and overpasses. Now the foot traffic was also bound up, as the magistratum checked IDs and gradually let them into the inner formal walks a few at a time. She waited patiently until the crawling line of traffic brought her up to a checkpoint. An officer approached. Plighton opened the cab window and flashed her warrant.
"Special Crime Department, I'm trying to get to work."
"Not this way, Marshal," the officer said. "Sorry. No road access to A along here."
"What do I do?"
The officer waved with his lumen baton in the fog.
"Turn east.
We're allowing Magistratum personnel into the formal along Parsonage Avenue. He turned. Magistratum, let it through.
Pleiken yanked on the anchor-shaped wheel and pulled through the gap he had indicated as other officers lifted aside a sawhorse barrier. Other traffic, omnibuses and private cargoes, hooted in disgust as they watched her slip through. Pleiken edged the Bergman along through packs of pedestrians slow to give way. Through the rain and the stroking wipers, she glimpsed a familiar face and thumped the horn. Grim, weary faces turned to scowl at her. She leaned out of her window. Limwall! Hey, Limwall! In the crowd, the department's skinny secretary officer, laden down with an armful of files, turned and saw her. Get in! Perplexed, he clambered in the passenger side, and Pleiken moved off through the crowd. Morning, she said. Is this yours? He asked, trying to wipe the sudden condensation off the fat lenses of his augmetic optics.
I borrowed it.
Who from?
My uncle.
And he's what? The playboy nephew of the Lord Governor Sub?
I know. Nice, isn't it?
Doesn't even begin to cover it. Throne, what a morning. Like a fool, I tried to walk in. Rail was closed.
You walked from Formal E.
He looked at her.
I served the Aquila.
What else was I supposed to do? I mean, what in the name of terror happened here last night?
I was hoping you could tell me that.
Limwall shrugged. I don't know much. I heard rumours that an attempt had been made on the Chief Provost's life last night.
Where? At the palace? Someone tried to kill Trice.
That's what I heard.
From?
People in the crowd.
Not a great source, Limwall.
Stick to your clerking. No one's crazy or powerful enough to try for Trice. Limwall glanced out of the window. You got a better explanation? She hadn't. The clogging tides of pedestrians had thinned out now, and they were making better time through almost deserted streets and sink routes that the barricades had closed off. Even so, they had to stop twice to allow unfriendly squads of PDF to check their authority. You realize that we're going to have to go all the way round the inner circle to get to Mag Central? Pleiten nodded. Better that than wait in a queue. Besides, this way we can stop in at the sacristy en route. I was going to have to go there this morning anyway. This saves me a trip.
If you don't mind.
Not at all, Limwall said. He was clearly enjoying his ride in the ornate roadster. By the way, speaking of the sacristy case, I pulled that file for you.
Yeah? From home?
Limwall blushed slightly.
Yes. Throne, please don't tell Rickens. He'll have my guts. I've enhanced the cogitator in my hab with department codes, so I can keep up with the workload after hours. I'd never manage otherwise.
Limwall, you know that after hours is meant for recreation, a relaxed meal, a drink or two with friends, maybe even a relationship?
If I didn't take the work home, I'd never meet the deputy's needs. 6 hours, maybe seven, I work off duty.
Don't tell me you never take work home.
Well,
yeah. Since when did you have a relationship?
Pleiten scowled and said nothing. Limwall pulled a file from his armful.
Here, I processed it last night. Basic stuff, like you said.
Early drawings? Templates? Street plans?
Uh-huh. Even records about the pioneer builders, pulled from the archives of Scolum Architectus. You ever hear of a man called Kaditsky?
There's a Kaditsky Square in Formal B.
Named after. Theodore Kaditsky. Thanks to him, the original city plan was what it was.
Bio?
It's all in there.
Pleiten reached one hand off the wheel, took the folder Limwall offered, and stuffed it into the driver's door pocket.
That's great, thanks. I think location is everything with the Allsman case. I mean, that hidden roof. It's got to be significant.
Well, just be careful. That data took a lot of digging out.
Unauthorized?
You mean you stole it?
Let's just say I bypassed some meanings of the word legitimate, Emperor forgive me.
Pleiten grinned. She pulled them to a halt in Templum Square. The towering facade of the Grand Templum rose above them. The place was quiet in the rain. In front of the Templum Arch, a few Magistratum vehicles were parked. The place was still cordoned off.
Wait here, she told him. I won't be long. Just a few more picts for the record.
I promised Rickens.
She got out of the Bergman and hurried into the cover of the portico. A pair of Magistratum officers approached. Mademoiselle, you can't...
Relax, special crime, she grinned, flashing her shield. This is my case.
She hurried in through the vast dome of the Templum, along the cloister and into the old sacristy.
She was checking the magnetic charge of her hand-picter when she realized a service-issue blunt was being aimed at her face.
"That's about far enough,"
a man's voice said.
"What, the throne?" she began.
"Really slow now. Hand me the picter."
Pleiton looked up, arms up. Two men stood before her, blocking the entrance. Both wore magistratum armor, but armor which entirely lacked any ident or badge. Their visors were down. Their handguns were threatening.
"Easy," she said. "I'm going to reach for my badge right now, okay?"
One of them nodded. She hooked out her shield. "Maud Pleiton, Junior Marshal. This is my case." One of the men took her warrant, studied it, then tossed it back to her.
"Not anymore," he said.
"What?"
"Interior cases is taking over, Marshal. Walk away."
"Wait a minute."
"Leave. Now," the other said. "This belongs to interior cases now."
"Why?"
"We don't have to tell you anything," said the first officer. "Report back to your department."
"You have to tell me one thing," Pleiton stated.
"Yeah, what?"
"Magistratum dictate 1780. Identity of officers. Who are you?"
"I told you. Interior cases."
"Names?"
"Marshals Weigott and Kuber." "All right. Are we done?"
"We're done," Pleiton said, and walked back to the Bergman. She parked the old roadster in the depths of the Rock Creek Bay under the central tower, left her permit on the dash, and went upstairs with Limwall. The Department of Special Crime was ominously silent. There was no one around, not even Mademoiselle Latilla. Under the cream-shaded electro-lamps of the wooden mezzanine, the desks were silent and unoccupied, the teetering towers of files and folders stirring in the processed breeze. Pleiton and Limwall looked at each other. They could hear voices raised in the deputy magistratum's private office. Pleiton sat down at her desk and code-entered her cogitator's data function along with the canticle of awakening. Surface data fluttered up, but nothing deep. All her precious records of the Olsman case, including the first round of pics she'd taken of the secret ceiling, were inaccessible. Blanked. Gone. That had never happened before. Well, that wasn't actually true. A year or so earlier, there had been a case, a street crime woman who had claimed she was an Imperial Inquisitor. Gideon something. Two men had come to see Rickens, and shortly afterwards the file trace had been erased. She queried, and Rickens had told her to forget it.
"No good will come of it," he'd said.
Pleiton had tried to forget about it, but it wasn't easy. She'd always assumed the affair had really concerned an Imperial Inquisitor. Why else would Rickens have erased the file? It made her feel better about it to think she was secretly serving the holy orders of the God Emperor. But this, what was the excuse this time? The main elevator hatch swished open, loud in the quiet office space. The breeze ruffled the stacked paper files. A squad of cogitator adepts from Technicus, escorted by a phalanx of magistratum marshals, entered the Special Crime Department. The adepts set to work at once, dismantling the department's cogitators.
"What the hell is this?" Limwall cried.
The marshals slammed him against a wall and began to beat him. Pleiton rose from her seat slowly. Weapons were aimed at her. The marshals were wearing the bright orange flame badges of interior cases.
"Stop it," Pleiton said. "Stop hitting him."
The visored marshals carried on punching and kicking Limwall until he fell down on the floor, one optic unit cracked.
"I want to know where in the name of the Emperor you find the authority to do this," Pleiton said.
The door of Rickon's office flew open, and a large man strode out. Pleiton recognized him immediately. Senior Magistratum Sankles, the head of the Interior Cases Division, the wing of the Magistratum that investigated the Magistratum itself. Sankles turned and yelled back into Rickon's office.
"Today, you hear me? Today!"
Walking past Pleiton, Sankles glared at her. Then he was gone.
"Maud,"
Rickens called from the door of his office. She hurried over to him, and he drew her inside and closed the door.
"What's going on?"
she asked. Rickens looked pale, as if in shock, and sat down in his ornate cathedra.
"Something,"
he said.
"Sir?"
He looked up at her.
"Maud," he said, "I'm going to hate myself for asking this, but did you knowingly break procedure when you investigated the Olsman death?"
"No, sir."
"I didn't think so. You recorded every particular of your crime scene entry?"
"Yes, sir."
"Every particular?"
"By the book, sir. What's going on?"
Rickens set his hands down on the console before him. His hands were shaking.
As of 9:20 this morning, the Department of Special Crime was suspended, pending investigation.
What?
Suspended. Interior Cases is taking over. There has been a submission that we have mishandled the Ulsman case. A lack of procedure. A cover-up.
Not at all, sir.
I know. I believe that, Maud. But Sankles has other ideas. We've been told to stand down, confined to domestic habs, while the investigation proceeds. Apparently there are strong links between our handling of the Ulsman death and the attempt on Chief Provost Trice's life last night.
Oh, my throne! They tried to kill him.
Who?
Sir, I have no idea. I heard rumours.
The rumours were true. And here we stand. I need your shield and your weapon, Maud.
What? Why?
Because as of now you are relieved of duty. Interior Cases will want to question you. You are required to return to your hab and wait there until they come.
I did nothing wrong.
I know, Maud. But still...
Plighton unhooked her token and unfastened her holster. She placed the shield and her weapon on Rickon's desk.
Go home and wait,
Rickens told her.
I'll try to get this affair straight as best I can.
Chapter 13. In its sleep, the Arethusa groaned gently. The layover at Eustace Majoris High Anchor meant there was time to afford a general system shutdown and a proper overhaul. Inert and slumbering, the old ship settled, its superstructure groaning and creaking as the stresses of the voyage were soothed away by the unexpected rest. Wandering the half-lit sub-tunnels and lower decks, Sholto Unworth was pleasantly reassured by the creaking and sighing of the metal hulk around him. The sounds made him think of the ship as alive. Besides, he'd sent the 20 men of his crew ashore for relaxation at the harbour taverns, and total silence would have been unnerving. Unworth was assessing the general repair of the ship. 3 small servitors clattered after him obediently. 2 were basic maintenance units. The 3rd carried a massive leather-cased book in its upper limbs, supporting it open as if its arms were a lectern. The book was the Arethusa's repair ledger. At every inspection point, Unworth would make some observations, then walk over to the book the servitor held for him. With an ink pen, Unworth carefully added any work needed to the manifest list, which the crew would consult later as they rostered for repair duties. A simple data slate would have done the job, but Unworth had a particular devotion to the sheer material substance of paper. The shipmaster's penmanship, like the shipmaster himself, was small and intricate.
Subduct? 1341. Lower service deck. Renew insulation on power trunking and replace digita valves 262 through 269,
he murmured to himself as he wrote, timing the words to the speed of his pen so they came out with an odd halting cadence. He screwed the lid back on the pen.
There. That is a sufficiency in this venue. Let us constitute ourselves to the next juncture.
He set off. The 3 servitors twitched and abruptly rattled along in his wake. He stopped suddenly and examined part of the dingy hallway's wall.
Oh, dear. Bless me now. That's unacceptable. See this formidable rustication?
The 3 servitors cocked their metal skulls.
Rustication of this magnetism is unacceptable, as it underwhelms the integrated solidnessity of the vessel.
Unworth unscrewed his pen and made some more fastidious notes.
Lower service deck. Treat rusticated wall patches with sealant. Also, buff, there said.
They continued with their tour and entered the gloomy cave of the ship's rear hold. It was a poor twilight in here, half the overhead lumens out of action. Unworth noted this carefully. There was also some buckling to several of the deck plates. Unworth had the 2 repair units hold up their photovoltaic lamps and aim the beams at the floor while he hunched down to inspect it. There was another creak of metal, but Unworth ignored it. He ran his fingers over the damaged deck section and tutted quietly. Then something blocked out the light of the lamps.
"Arise them, gainfully, you defuncts," he called out.
He was still in shadow.
"You,"
said a voice. It was low, so very, very deep. Sholto Unworth turned and gazed up at the titanic figure behind him. He blinked. He knew all too well who this man was and what line of business he was in.
"I do not have a remembrance of inviting you aboard my ship, Master Vorna,"
he said, trying, and for the most part, failing to keep the note of anxiety out of his voice.
"That's because you didn't, Unworth,"
replied Lucius Vorna.
"You know my name?"
"Sholto Unworth, shipmaster of the Arethusa. It's my business to know facts like that, particularly as I've been looking for you."
"Looking for me? Why for have you been looking for me?"
"Because we're going to have a conversation."
"I have nothing to converse with you, sir. My lips are soiled."
"I heard you usually had plenty to say, Unworth. A babbler. That's what I've heard. Plenty to say, and 90% of it crap. I'm interested in the 10% of sense you sometimes manage."
Unworth drew himself up to his full height, which put his eyes on a level with Vorna's navel, and said,
"I would be most ingratuitous if you were kindly permissive and removed your personable from my ship."
Lucius Vorna turned casually and struck one of the repair servitors with the back of his hand. The force of the brutal slap sent the delicate machine tumbling across the deck, dented and cracked, sparks fizzling from torn hoses and servo meshes.
"A conversation,"
he rumbled.
"End of story."
Vorna took the shipmaster up to the small retiring lounge behind the bridge. En route, Unworth saw other intruders aboard his ship, rough-looking crew types, all of them armed with handguns. They were standing watch at hatches and junctions, ready to greet any of Unworth's own crew who came back. Several more were on the bridge itself, searching through the database and the paper records. Unworth would have been bristling with outrage if total fear hadn't been eclipsing every other emotion and thought. He was not a brave man, and avoided confrontation at all costs. In a quiet life of trading, he'd never been boarded, never been attacked, and never had his life and welfare threatened so comprehensively. He said nothing, just did what he was told. Vorna indicated he should sit down on the leather bench built into the retiring cabin's end wall. Vorna remained standing. The bounty hunter idly began to unclasp and remove the armored gauntlets of his carapace armor, and set them on a side table. His big hands were as scarred and gnarled as his head.
"You were at Bonner's Reach for Firetide."
Unworth shrugged, not sure if it was a question, and not at all certain he wanted to answer it if it was.
"Then you came down the sublane during the course of the season via Oncage, Bostol, that route, and ended up here 6 days ago."
Unworth shrugged again.
"Good trip, was it? Good trade. You carry cargo?"
"Some pulchritude of an amount. It has been a poor season."
"Gonna get worse yet,"
Vorna said.
"What about passengers?"
Unworth said nothing. Vorna smiled.
"You're afraid of me, aren't you?"
"I cannot receive of a notion why I shouldn't be."
"Damn right. I'm a scary man. And maybe that's what's gluing up your famous blabbermouth. Maybe you'd be happier talking to a kindred soul."
Vorna went to the cabin door and beckoned for someone. A red-haired man in a jacket of vitrine glass entered the room.
"Hello, Unworth," he said. "You know who I am?"
Unworth nodded.
"Master Siskind of the Allure."
"Now don't mind Lucius here. He's working for me. Help me out, and I won't pay him to damage you."
"I am most revived to hear so, Master Siskind. In what fashionable way can I help you?"
"Let me start by apologizing, Unworth," Siskind said. "Boarding your ship like this, taking control. No master likes to be treated like that."
"Indeed not."
"But understand, until I get what I want, my men will remain in control. And any of your crew who tries to alter that fact will regret it. I'm looking for the October Country, Unworth. I'm looking for the October Country and its master, Kizari Thekla."
Unworth cleared his throat.
Then you have importuned your radiation in the unrequisite direction, Master Siskind. I am not he, nor is he here, in manner of fact. When last I left my eyes on him, he was at the Reach, during Firetide.
You saw him there? Siskind said, picking up an astrolabe from a shelf and toying with it.
In consideration, yes. I spoke at him. He was deferably present, as was Master Akunin and other worthied eminences of their cartel.
All of whom had left the Reach by the time I put in, Siskind told Vorna. He looked back at Unworth. What did you talk to Thekla about?
I took a meeting with the beneficial master and extravagated about mercantile dealings that might arise perspicaciously between our two selves.
Siskind burst out laughing.
Unworth, Unworth, the cartel Thekla and Akunin belong to is out of my league, let alone yours. How do you deal with the shame, trying to broker deals with men like that? Throne, you're a nothing. A nobody midget in a tramp ship.
Blinking hard, Unworth looked aside.
Listen to me, Unworth, Siskind said. I was supposed to meet Thekla at the Reach, but I was delayed. By the time I'd got there, he'd gone. Under normal circumstances, he would have left a message for me. But he didn't. Naturally, I was worried. So I hired Master Vorna to do some hunting around. Guess what he turned up?
I have no ideology of that answer, Unworth said.
Just after Firetide, a bulk lifter, registered, according to its transponder codes, to the October country, docked at Bonner's Reach. Its occupants were not identified. In fact, the vigilance records show the lifter's occupants chose anonymity. But there's one thing the records do show. Those people, whoever they were, took a private meeting with you. Shortly after, this heap of junk left the Reach and began its journey here.
Who were those people?
Vorna asked.
I can't quite reminisce,
Unworth began.
Don't give me that, Siskind spat. We saw the records. Facts, Unworth. Don't embarrass yourself with a lie. Either you met with Thekla, or with representatives of his ship, or you met with people who had somehow acquired a lifter belonging to the October country. Which was it?
Sholto Unworth, so small his feet swung off the bench seat and didn't reach the ground, bravely shook his head.
You carried passengers on this run, didn't you?
Vorna growled.
All the way from the Reach to Eustace.
Just cargo,
Unworth said.
Onalis?
Siskind called. Another man came into the cabin and handed Siskind one of the Arethusa's leather-bound manifests. Siskind skimmed through the pages to the last entry.
Here, in your own hand, Unworth. Passage arranged from Bonner's Reach to Eustace Majoris. 8 persons. Price agreed. No names recorded.
Unworth knew when lying was hopeless.
I was pertained by those persons to act as conveyance. They have quit the ship now.
Who were they?
Traders, I conceive. I asked no query of them.
Come on, you little bastard.
If I knew names,
Unworth blurted,
I would not obligate you with them. A shipmaster and his clients enrapture the principles of privatization and confidence. As a master yourself, you know that.
You know,
grinned Siskind, handing the manifest back to his first officer.
I admire your professionalism, Unworth. I really do. Client confidentiality. That's something I try to uphold in every circumstance. But I'd waive the privilege like a shot if my ship was being held by force, and I was in the same room as Lucius Vorna. So, give me the damn names.
No,
said Unworth.
All right. Answer this. What do you know of a man named Gideon Ravener?
Nothing,
said Sholto Unworth, flatly. Siskind turned to Vorna.
Your witness, he said.
Lucius Vorna reached into a belt pouch and took something out that began to chitter and vibrate.
Know what a sizer is?
He asked. Unworth shook his head and slowly shrank back into the couch until he could go no further.
Well, said Vorna, you're going to find out, unless you answer the questions. Do you know Gideon Ravener?
Yes,
said Unworth.
He was your passenger, him and his team.
Yes,
Unworth said in a tiny, tiny voice.
Now we're getting somewhere. What happened to Thekla and his ship?
I don't know. In absolution, I do not. They did not tell me.
Maybe they didn't. All right. Here's another. Where is Ravana and his crew now?
I don't know. On the surface. That's all I can explicate, to the best margin of my knowing.
On the surface. Mm-hmm. And how do you contact them?
I don't. Our arrangementage is finished.
You must know where they are, what they're doing.
I implore you, I don't. They made a special immensity of not telling me the pertinence of their business. They said I shouldn't know for the good of my health.
Lucius Vorner slowly raised the sawing sizer.
How wrong they were, he said.
Chapter 14. Piece by piece, Carl Thonius was extracting the secrets of Tchaikov's riddle box. He'd been deciphering for 2 days. He wrote every scrap of data down on index cards and soft-gummed them to the wall of the east bedroom, rearranging them as more details fitted in. The entire wall was speckled with cards. Every once in a while, Carl went to his cogitators and checked a fact via his link to the Informium, or ran details through his arithmometer. The sheer scale of the Contract 13 operation was becoming evident. It had been going on for years. I had suspected that thousands of tainted devices had been smuggled into Petropolis, but the actual figure was currently close to 5 million. 5 million. If that were true, vast substrates of the Administratum in the Hive were currently using warp-infected engines on a daily basis, and the Contract 13 cartel had become very rich indeed. It was evident from the funds Tchaikov had been laundering for them. The contract itself had paid out well, regularly, and it had been fearsomely supplemented by the trade in flects. The foolish trade in flects. The greedy side order they hadn't been able to resist, the very reason I had discovered their vile dealings in the first place. Their own greed had betrayed them. I was still troubled by the deeper connections, the vein of cogitae that ran through the players in this game. Thekla, Tchaikov, Siskind, though I didn't think that last fool was a player any more. Trice intrigued me, given his power and status, and Carl had been unable to draw up any background on the man. But I knew he employed powerful psychers. Kinski, for one, and the unidentified fellow at the diplomatic palace. Then, of course, there had been the assassination attempt itself. Trice had other enemies, enemies who could conjure an incunabula. My gut feeling was the divine frattery. Carl's initial findings showed they had cells operating on Eustace. That made me especially wary. I was locked into their future predictions, their prospects. If they were attacking Trice, that meant my struggle with the cartel was somehow interfering with the fearful event that they were so keen to see happen. So many pieces, like a vast game of regicide. At the center of it all, I worried, was the mysterious, prophesied figure known as Slight. The divine frattery's messiah. What was he? What was it? Zael's true name was Sleet. He was a mirror farseer, and so, by Eisenhorn's definition, especially luminous to the freighters. Had I really been so gullible as to accept a demon into my midst? Was my sympathy for Zael my undoing, and the undoing of a subsector besides? I prayed not. I was a man of careful, considered ambition. Though everything pointed to Zael, that seemed too easy. From experience, I know the universe is a far, far more complex mechanism. I hovered behind Carl as he continued his work. He seemed to me to be edgy and restless. When he misstuck a key on the board of his cogitator, he cursed and oathed. Gently.
So much data, he murmured. So much to coordinate. It gets me worked up.
One thing we had fathomed from the riddle box. Some of the cartel members had grown so rich on their profits that they had already quit and retired. That was virtually unheard of, a rogue trader selling up his ship and retiring to a life of luxury. But such were the vast earnings of these men. Marabos had purchased an entire island on Messina. Braden had retreated to a castellated abbey above the Great Falls on Mirepoix. Counting their money, no doubt, rolling in it. Athan Strikeson had sold his ship, and, combining that huge fund with his cartel earnings, had bought a retreat in a private canton of his homeworld. Athens Strikeson came from Eustace Majoris. The place he had purchased was in Farthingale, a rural seat 1,500 kilometres inland from Petropolis Hive. For the first time in our investigation, we had an opportunity to meet with a cartel member face to face. Nail, Kiss, and Mathewin were en route right now. They were going to ask the ex-shipmaster a few pointed questions.
"So much data,"
Carl complained again, pasting another card on the wall.
"Couldn't Zale help?"
"No," I transponded. "I sent him to the kitchen to brew you some calf. Truth was, I wanted Zale as far away from this as possible. If he was slight." There was a chime alarm. I heard Frauke go to the front door. He came back and leaned in to see me. "It's the physician," he said. I left Carl to his work and hovered down to greet Belknap. True to his promise, he'd come back to check on Kara. He stood in the doorway, his bag in his hand. "Medicae? Inquisitor? I appreciate this. Good. Come up." He followed me up the stairs. He was a good man, a very principled man. I could feel that now, just as Kiss had told me. We went down the upper corridor towards Kara's room. A cry stopped him in his tracks. "What was that?" he asked. "Nothing that needs to concern you, Doctor," I replied. Another cry. "You want me to trust you, don't you?" Belknap said, turning to face me. "What the throne was that?" "Our guest," I replied. "He does that from time to time." "Let me see him." "No." "Then I'm leaving, Ravana." "Very well." I led Belknap down the hall and nudged open the door of Sko's room. Pulling at his shackles, Sko screamed again for effect.
"Holy throne," Belknap said, gazing into the room.
"They're chafing me," Sko cried. "They're chafing my wrists so sore."
He held up the manacles to show us.
"This is disgraceful," Belknap said. "Sko is my prisoner, a dangerous man. Don't pity him, whatever you do," I said. Belknap glowered at me. "He is a man even so, stricken in health. My oath as a Medicae means I have to see to him." "Very well."
Belknap walked over to Sko and examined his manacles. "You have to release him. The binders are rubbing him raw, and the sores are infected."
"He is an enemy of the Imperium, Doctor," I said. "The binders stay on."
"Then I have to take him to the local Medicae facility."
"No," I said. "I told you that secrecy was our only power here. Take Sko to the local infirmary, and he'll blow our cover. He knows too much."
"Then what would you have me do, Inquisitor?"
"Treat him."
Belknap produced a liniment from his bag and began to smooth the cream into Sko's wrists.
"It's a start," he said, "but I'm still not happy."
Kara Swole was asleep when we went in. The medical apparatus Belknap had ordered was set up around her bed, pulsing and blinking.
"Glory,"
Belknap said, looking at the equipment. "I made a list of things that would be useful, and you went out and bought them all? I value Kara very much."
"All this stuff,"
Belknap said. "You don't blink at the price. I could have equipped an entire low-stack surgery with this.
What kind of people are you?"
"The kind that will donate all of this to your practice once we're done," I said. He sat down on the edge of the bed and started to examine Kara's belly wound. She rolled in her sleep and mumbled. I went out of the room. "Vox from Nail," Frauke said. "They're in position and await your pleasure."
"Understood," I said. "Listen, Whiston, things are going to be quiet around here for a few hours. Why don't you take Zale to a gallery, maybe a museum? With so few of us around, I'd rather not leave him here to his own devices, given what you told me."
"I understand," he said. "You want him kept away from anything sensitive when there's no one around. No problem." He went off to find the boy. I slid into Carl's room. "I'm going bodiless to work with Harlan. Whiston's taking Zale on an excursion, so you'll be able to concentrate on the work."
"Good,"
he said. "Don't forget to check on Sko."
"Of course not."
I went back into my private room, locked off my chair's mobilizers, and sent my mind into the sky. Wearing Zeph Mathewin, I walked up the gravel path to join Kiss and Harlan. Farthingale was a quiet interior town of broad avenues and pollarded trees. The sky was cloudy and morose. Athen Strikeson's mansion lay before us. "Let's go and present ourselves," I said. We walked down to the gatehouse. Through the locked iron gates we could see a dark space of lawn, and a path lined with enamel obelisks that led up to the mansion's main doors. Kiss rang the bell pull. The three of us were wearing simple black suits and long coats of grey wool.
"Who visits?"
the vox speaker on the gatehouse wall crackled. Kiss leaned close to the speaking cone.
"Department of Tithe and Tariff," she replied.
"You said your name was Belknap?"
Kara asked. She was sitting in the chair beside her bed. Her cheeks were pale and drawn. "That's right," he said, adjusting the dials of one of the machines.
"What you're doing, all these tests, is very thorough."
"I'm a thorough person, Mademoiselle Swall."
"Even so. You were injured by a so-called vampire blade,"
Belknap said.
"The injury is more than a stab wound.
I need to run a complete biological audit to make sure there are no secondary problems."
"You've stabilized the blade wound. It's no longer a threat."
"Yes, but as I said, I need to..."
Kara looked at Belknap.
"There's no need for the cover story, Doctor. The fact you want to run more tests has nothing to do with the blade injury. You picked up on something else while you were treating that."
"I know."
"I see.
So, go on." Kara stared at him, smiling. Belknap took a deep breath and handed her a display slate. "The expensive instruments your master has brought in don't lie. You know what this is?"
"I knew before the blade bit me,"
Kara said flatly. "Did you?"
"Of course. I checked myself on a weekly basis using Unworth's autodoc."
"Who's Unworth?" he asked.
"Doesn't matter," she replied quickly. "What matters is that I know what this is. Astroblastoma. Last year I took a leap off a docking bay in a vac suit, exposed myself to megawatts of rad. I hoped the suit was shielded."
"I don't think it was."
"Seems so. How long have I got?"
Belknap looked at the floor. "No more than 6 months, Mademoiselle Swall. I'm sorry."
"Why? It's not your fault."
"Treatments?" "The condition is terminal. You understand that? There are certain palliatives that can make you more comfortable, and angiogenesis inhibitors that buy you a little more time, although carcinomatosis has begun."
"The cancer spreading to other parts of my body, you mean?"
"Yes. Or you were so comprehensively irradiated you are developing multiple oncological responses."
"How long will I remain active?"
"With good fortune and the proper care, 3 or 4 months," Belknap replied. "Look, you need some rest now. I'll come back tomorrow, and we can discuss how we're going to approach your treatment."
"We?"
Kara asked. "You're my patient now," he said. Kara reached out a hand and caught him gently by the sleeve.
"One thing, Master Belknap, more important than anything else. Please don't tell anyone about this yet. Not my friends, not Ravana, especially not Ravana. All right?"
Belknap nodded. Chapter 15.
"You're who?"
asked the housekeeper warily.
"Department of Tithe and Tariff,"
Kiss repeated politely. She showed the man her permit, and Harlan and I did the same. The man looked at them with some alarm, but seemed convinced. He ought to be. The permits were authentic. Carl had got them for us from the Informium itself. We had been let into the vestibule of Strikeson's home. It was gloomy and cold. Though the day was grey and overcast, no interior lights had been switched on. There wasn't any sound except the ticking of a long-cased cron and the clack of rooks cawing reedily out in the damp gardens.
"What's this about?"
the housekeeper said. In my opinion, he was the least convincing thing around. A hard-bodied man in early middle age, he seemed more like a guard than a housekeeper. His voice and gestures certainly lacked the poise and polish that might have been expected of a senior servant or butler.
"We've been sent to undertake a surprise inspection of Master Strikeson's financial records," Kiss said.
"What? Why?" asked the man.
"We should discuss that with Master Strikeson himself, or with a clerk who can legally speak on his behalf."
As Kiss spoke with him, I looked into his mind and learned some basic facts. His name was Geren Felt, and he was a member of Strikeson's house security.
a few days earlier, following some incident in the hive, news of which had greatly distressed Strikeson. The house staff had been scaled down to security personnel only. Felt had been ordered to act as housekeeper and answer any calls. Things were afoot, but Felt was too junior to be privy to what. All he was sure of was that he had to check the sudden arrival of Imperial tax inspectors with his superiors.
"Wait here, please,"
he said, and hurried off. He took our permits with him.
Strikeson's expecting trouble. I sent as we waited.
"Figures,"
Kiss answered.
"He must have heard that Chaikov's dead by now, so he knows the cartel is potentially under threat, and he is the most visible member."
I gently scanned the building. "There are 8 people here with us. No, 9. A general sense of anxiety and suspicion directed at us. Tension."
I sensed Nail about to place a hand under his coat.
"No, I told you how we'd play this."
Nail's hand slid out.
Felt returned. He didn't have our permits, nor did he pass any comment on their absence.
"This way, if you please."
He led us out of the vestibule, into a wide hall where a grand staircase rose above us, along another stretch of corridor, under an arch, and into a large salon, intended for the entertainment of guests. The short trip was illuminating to me. I sensed the primed sentry gun pods concealed behind the vestibule doors, auto-tracking our heat as we went by. I sensed the guard with the hell gun poised behind the side arch of the hall, and the other 2 guards, both armed with las rifles, up on the staircase landing, out of sight. I felt the heartbeats of the men concealed behind the salon doors, weapons drawn, ready to enter. I touched the hard metal shapes of remote-operated plasma beamers in the false wall behind the salon's wood paneling, their focus nozzles aimed at us. I saw the electromagnetic shimmer of the multiple security pictures tracking us as we walked, and gently psi-blurred our features so they wouldn't read cleanly. And I sensed the aide in an adjoining chamber, frantically checking our permits via a secure voxlink to Petropolis. The house staff are all around us, armed and ready to spring. Automated weapons systems, too. The house is wired. Be wary, but show no sign. Let's see how this plays.
Tea? Caffeine, perhaps?
Felt said awkwardly. From his agitated surface thoughts, I knew he had a sting blunt tucked into the waistband of his trousers, though he wasn't thinking about how quickly he could draw it. He was calculating which item of furniture in the room he should throw himself behind if things went awry.
"No, thank you," said Kiss.
We stood, waiting. I felt the tension swell to bursting point, the men hidden around us on a hair trigger. I sent my mind back to the aide in the nearby chamber, watched as he spoke on the vox, read out our permit numbers, waited, and finally nodded.
"They're clear. Genuine," he called.
The automated weapon systems switched to safety and depowered. The waiting men stood down and retreated.
"We're fine."
Athan Strikeson came into the salon. He was a tall, long-faced man with thin black hair and quick, intelligent eyes. He wore a well-tailored suit of Selpik Tash and nodded to us politely.
"I wasn't told to expect a visit," he said.
He had our permits in his hand. He waved Felt out of the room.
"The department makes special visits from time to time, unannounced. In our experience, notification of a visit sometimes gives a citizen undue opportunity for concealment."
Kiss smiled at him.
"I'm sorry if this is inconvenient. You are Athan Strikeson?"
"Yes, I am. Can you tell me what this is about?" "You've recently taken up residence here on Eustace Majoris,"
Nail asked.
"I have. I'm retired. I bought this place 9 months ago."
"Your previous employment was as a shipmaster?"
Kiss said.
"I was an owner-master. 79 years. Made my fortune, as they say, and came here to enjoy it. Look, my financial agents logged all my records with your department for the purposes of disclosure and estimation of tariff burden. Everything is in order."
"Indeed," said Nail. He opened the small black case he was carrying and took out a data slate.
"The finance agency you retain has been very forthcoming and thorough. However, we have found a discrepancy that they are unable to account for."
Strikeson's face darkened.
"I do hope not. It cost me a significant sum to set up residency on this world. I did everything by the book, under advice. Paid what seemed like extravagant sums to the taxation department in recognition of my base worth. There were additional tariffs, settlement clauses, exchange considerations. Adopting the life of a simple citizen of this fine world cost me an exorbitant amount, which I gave freely. I did not expect further swinging demands to be made.
Of course not, Kiss said.
Though that is perhaps a matter you should take up with your finance agents, Nail added.
We are just doing our job, Kiss said.
I know, I know, Strikeson said, half smiling and raising his hand. I had been probing him gently while the discourse distracted him. He was wearing a psi blocker in a silver charm around his neck, a fairly powerful device, but nothing like strong enough to keep me out. By the time he was half smiling and raising his hand, I had deactivated it and moved into his mind. What I found there was a curious mixture of annoyance and relief. Strikeson had indeed been told about Chaikov's demise. He'd had a call from Akunin, warning him. Akunin had been furious, complaining that Trice had refused to meet with him to discuss the matter.
The bastard would take it seriously, Akunin had told Strikeson. He thinks Chaikov fell foul of a black market rival.
That's possible, isn't it? Strikeson had said.
We chose her in the first place because she was a genuine player, Akunin had said. No underworld rival would dare go up against her. Just watch yourself, Athen. If someone's onto us, you will be next. You're the easiest one of us to find.
Scared, Strikeson had sealed his house and waited for the worst. Our knock on the door had jarred his nerves. He'd come very close to panic. Now, as it seemed, he had an impertinent but authentic visit from the tithe department to deal with. His relief was considerable. He thought for a moment some nemesis, the sort of force that had slaughtered Chaikov and her retinue, had found him. All the same, he was exasperated. He'd been assured by the ministry operatives who had overseen his settlement that his tax affairs would not be subject to scrutiny by the Department of Tithe and Tariff, one more perk of Contract 13. From his surface thoughts, I could read all the things that he thought had been covered up, all the things he was afraid might come out. Undeclared funds, sequestered shares, false business accounts, unpaid duty on... There we go. I didn't want to rip into his mind and strip it. I didn't want him to even know what I was doing. This form of telepathic manipulation was akin to hypnotism, to gentle persuasion, to suggestion. His brain whirling with financial concerns, he was ripe and ready to give everything up. Master Strikeson, I said, speaking for the first time, there is the matter of mercantile process duty. I spoke the words, forming Mathewin's voice into a smooth tone that would play mesmerically with a susceptible mind, but I also cast them, a telepathic echo to the speech. The echo was what really got under his skin.
Process duty?
On the sale of your vessel, the Bucentaur. If the affidavits of fiscal gain and letters of dispensation signed by the agents are accurate, then the figures for anchorage tax and mercantile process duty are out by a factor of 32%. The true figure was 26, but I wanted him to be alarmed. A startled mind is even easier to control.
32?
In Warfinger revenues alone, it is off by a margin of 0.9. But mercantile process is our main concern, the department's key area of discrepancy. The freight stamps are overdue by 8 years.
8 years,
said Nail, pretending to consult his slate.
8 years,
Strikeson said, sitting down. And the tonnage band is wrongly declared.
And the tonnage band is wrongly declared, Kiss said.
The Bucentaur was a class 7.
Because the Bucentaur was a class 7, she finished.
Throne,
Strikeson whispered.
What is the duty remaining?
The duty outstanding at this time, I said. Allowing for interest is this, Athen. How long were you working for the cartel?
Still caught up in his financial worries, Strikeson shrugged.
No more than 4 years.
He thought he was telling us about freight stamps.
Who brought you in?
Akunin and Weigold.
How many runs did you make to the Mergent Worlds?
9.
Strikeson murmured, believing he had just explained how hard it was to get the fiscal reserve to advance mortgage on a ship sale.
Yes, that is always a difficulty, I said aloud.
The sale was handled by the brokers of the Navis Nobility,
Strikeson said.
Gods, this is terrible. I need caffeine. Do you need caffeine?
You don't need caffeine.
I don't need caffeine,
he said,
sitting down again, shaking his head.
"Sorry, what did you just ask me?"
"Why did you leave the cartel?"
"I'd earned enough. I mean, more than I'd ever dreamed. I was tired of the void. It seemed like a good opportunity."
He paused and looked up, puzzled.
Was I just talking about why I retired?"
he said. I tightened my mental hold slightly, like a wrestler changing grips.
"No, Athan. You are telling me who you worked for. Who organized Contract 13? "Oh, well, it was a Coonan show. Him and Thekla, to begin with. They brought the rest of us in. A Coonan liked to boast that his orders came from Yeda Trice. But Thekla once told me that was just what a Coonan liked to say, pretending he had a direct line to the Chief Provost. The actual orders came via the secretists."
"Who are the secretists?" Strikeson looked up and smiled. In his mind, he was gleefully telling me how the Navis Nobilitae brokers couldn't be trusted with a decent ship sail if their eyes depended on it. His mouth was saying,
"I don't know. That's the point. The secretists are secret. They enforce the will of the Diadochoi. They cover up and protect his actions. And they're bloody good at it, too. Throne, I wouldn't want to cross one of them. I met one once, at a dinner. Revoke, his name was. Akunin's chief contact. The man was a monster. A stone killer."
"What else can you tell me about this Revoke?"
"Nothing. Not much. Yellow eyes. That's what I remember. Yellow friggin' eyes."
Strikeson's voice trailed off. As far as he would remember, he'd just said,
"Never trust a broker. They don't include windfall tariff in their estimates. And they try to claw 13% back at the sale."
"What is the Diadochoi?"
"The heir. The successor. The one that shall be."
"Is Yeda Trice the Diadochoi?"
Strikeson laughed out loud and stood up. "Of course not. He's just the chief facilitator. The Diadochoi's right-hand man."
"Sit back down." He sat, subdued suddenly. "The Diadochoi is someone more senior than the chief provost."
"Yes, of course," Strikeson said quietly.
With Zeph's eyes, I glanced at Kiss and Harlan.
"What is the purpose of Contract 13?
Kiss sent seductively. Strikeson looked up.
"To obtain data engines from the Mergent Worlds, Spica Maximal particularly, and supply them to the ministries here on Eustace Majoris."
"For what purpose?"
Strikeson blinked. "I honestly have no idea," he said. He wasn't lying.
"Let us consider your duty claims and compensatories," I said.
"Oh, all right,"
sighed Athan Strikeson. Chapter 16. Late afternoon. The city, blurred by rain, outside the windows. The special crime office should have been bustling at this hour. But interior cases had suspended everyone the morning before, and technicians had dismantled all the cogitators and taken them away, along with the mountains of paperwork and file cartons. The quiet was funereal. Even the air systems had been turned off. Rickens wandered the length of the main office space, his cane tapping. This was so wrong. In all his years of devoted service, he'd never... He heard a hatch open behind him and turned. Sankles, big and barrel-chested in his service uniform, strode up between the empty desks until he was face to face with Rickens. Straight-backed compared to Rickens' hunched posture, Sankles was significantly younger, taller, and more massive than the deputy magistratum. He looked down at Rickens with hooded eyes.
"You got my message?"
"Yes,"
said Rickens.
"It's for the best,"
Sankles said.
"A man with your career record and good reputation, with retirement prospects. It makes sense. This is a dreadful mess, Rickens, and there's no need to be dragged down with it. A quiet resignation, retirement on non-specific health grounds. Your pension will be secure. You'll be clear of anything that transpires. And you come in and clean house once I'm gone."
"Simply put," said Sankles. He held out his hand, palm up.
"So?"
"So?
Your resignation, Deputy Rickens."
"You honestly thought I'd fold and make it that easy for you, Sankles?"
Rickens said.
The head of interior cases colored slightly and withdrew his hand.
"Don't do this," he breathed through clenched teeth. "Don't even begin to."
"I am an officer of the Imperial Magistratum," Rickens said.
sworn to uphold civic law and the justice of the Emperor of Mankind. I protect the codes and practices that make our common freedom possible. I am not going to stand aside and make things easy for you."
Sankles turned away and then snapped back round again, aiming a finger at Rickon's face. Rickon's didn't flinch.
"You don't even begin to comprehend what you're dealing with,"
Sankles shouted.
"No, I don't,"
Rickon's agreed calmly.
"I have absolutely no idea what is going on, what great darkness interior cases is closing ranks to conceal, except that my department has clearly stumbled on something important, and has therefore been selected to take the fall."
"You—"
"I'll finish what I'm saying, Sankles. I know your department's close connection to the Ministry of Subsector Trade. I know your close cooperative relationship with the Chief Provost. I don't question that the attempt on Provost Trice's life the other night was an act to be deplored by us all. I accept there may be matters of confidence, state secrets that I cannot be party to. But I will not allow my department to be sacrificed. If I resign, there will be no process of inquiry, no impediment to the swift and total disintegration of special crime."
Rickens took a sheaf of papers from his coat pocket.
"I have been in correspondence today, sir, with the Justiciary, the Advocates Department, and the Office of the Subsector Arbites. I have consulted with legal counsel. If I refuse to resign, you'll have to impeach me or charge me. Either way, there will be a thorough legal examination of this matter. No cover-up. No conspiracy. If the accusations leveled against this department and the men and women who serve it are true, you will have to evidence those facts and develop a case that the Justiciary can try. If we're guilty, let us be found guilty. I will not be party to a backroom coup and the indiscriminate usurpation of constitutional process by a department that, in my opinion, is too powerful already. Interior cases is part of the law, Sankles, not above it. And you'll refuse to resign quietly, just to prove that point." "I won't budge, Sankles. I see it as my duty to the throne itself."
Sankles looked Rickens up and down, slowly.
"Investigation and trial will destroy you, Rickens. Your reputation, your good name. I was trying to spare you the shame and the ignominy."
"I don't think that's what you were doing at all,"
Rickens said. He walked past Sankles and headed for the door.
"I'm going home now. Tomorrow morning I have the first of what I imagine will be a considerable number of meetings with Justiciary Counsel in preparation for your investigation. They will, of course, require access to all the files and digital documents you removed from this office. And I'm sure that one of their first recommendations will be for me to contact the Officio Inquisitoris Planitia to inform them of the impending legal action."
Sankles started to say something, then closed his mouth.
"Good night to you, sir,"
said Rickens, and left the room. Sankles stood alone for a moment, then took his hand vox from its belt pouch. He selected a secure channel.
"This is Sankles. I'm going to need a meeting with the Chief Provost at his earliest convenience."
Orfeo Kalzean was sipping nettle tea and reading when the freighters called upon him unannounced. It was early evening, and the climate in the Regency Viceroy suite had been notched up to counter the inclement weather outside. Kalzean sat at a desk, surrounded by old manuscripts, ancient documents recorded in slate form and crumbling books. The current volume under inspection was written in a Zeno script, and he was having to hold up a bulky brass translation viewer in front of his eyes like opera glasses. The semivolpa was playing under his chair. Orfeo Kalzean had almost filled the memory of a data slate with notes from his reading. Enuncia. He wondered if it could possibly be true.
"The Fritters have come to see you,"
Layla Slade said. Kalzean lowered his viewer.
"Now?"
"Shall I tell them you're not available?"
"No, I am in their employ. Show them in. But, Layla..."
"Sir?"
"Lurk, please."
She nodded. She showed the freighters in.
"Freighter Artus, Freighter Stifoy,"
Kalzean said as he rose to his feet. The men bowed. Not so much respect today, Kalzean thought. Their real eyes were patched.
"We look upon you, Orfeo Kalzean," said Stifoy.
"I wasn't expecting you,"
Kalzean said.
"Would you care for refreshment?"
"No, thank you,"
said Artus. He took a small piece of folded silk out of his pocket with his scarred fingers and unwrapped it. In the center was the buckled piece of focus ring. for your collection, as requested. Calzean took it and examined it.
Wonderful. Thank you. But I can't believe the two of you came here just to give me this.
No, said Stefoy. The Magus Clancula asked us to attend you and update you on the prospect.
As per your advice, Artus said. The Frattery has been examining the meniscus to see what determiners may have changed and how this may affect the likelihood of the prospect.
You'll be pleased to know that the percentage likelihood has not declined. Indeed, said Stefoy, it may have increased. Though still living, Trice may have altered as a determiner.
I expected as much. Trice will be fearful and cautious. That will stay his hand, and to our advantage. Good. I'm pleased.
Artus took out a piece of paper. Also, one of the newer determiners has been read as becoming significantly more important during the last 10 hours.
Indeed. A negative?
Asked Calzean.
No, a positive, replied Artus.
Calzean took the paper and read it.
This name again. Do we know who it is? Who it means?
We're looking into that now, replied Stefoy.
Belknap,
Calzean murmured to himself.
Belknap.
The good doctor had gone for the day. Kara was asleep, and Miseramus was quiet. Carl Thonius left his whirring cogitators and the wall of pasted index cards for a moment, and walked about the halls and landings of the house to clear his head and loosen his limbs. He felt ill, and he knew why. He tried to put it out of his mind, but it nagged. The need pecking at the shell of his resolve. It should never have got like this, he thought to himself. Never. He was a fool, and if he didn't stop, he would be found out, and everything would be bad. Carl paused in front of a full-length mirror in the hallway. He saw himself, looking tired, sort of ill. His skin was pale and dry, his eyes shadowed. But still, he thought, I cut quite a dash. The black tunic coat and trousers, the black boots, a subtle look today, though that subtlety was perfectly counterpointed by the Khazarite brooch on his lapel. Then he thought about what he was doing. Looking in a mirror. Looking in a mirror. In a mirror. In... He tried to look away, but the feeling had dug too deep already. He walked into his room, opened a locked compartment in his trunk, and took out one of the parcels wrapped in red tissue paper. He unwrapped it, his hands shaking, drew a deep breath, and looked down into the flecked. What marvels this time? What rapture would... He went blind. No, not blind. Deaf. No, not deaf. Falling. He was falling. There was a pit filled with the darkest smoke of old night and the flicker of forgotten suns spinning into oblivion, and an oak-cone moaning that crackled like an untuned vox. And there was something there in the darkness, swooping around him as he fell into the infinite, his mouth screaming but making no sound. Something pale and cold, yet burning, something anguished and spavined, something old, something so dreadful. Sheer inarticulate terror infected Carl Thonius like a disease and snorted like a beast behind his eyes. His blood froze solid, crackling in his veins, his heart seized, a dead leaden weight in his chest. His eyes caught fire, and he died. Chapter 17. A terrible, stunning blow struck the back of his head. It was the floor. He lay on his back, twitching, gurgling, then went still. Seconds passed with glacial slowness. The cogitators clicked and hummed, auto-processing. Lamplight glinted off the open riddle box and the shattered flecked on the floor. With a sudden gasp, Carl sat up. He panted furiously, blinking. He tried to remember where he was, who he was. There was a terrible taste in his mouth. He looked around and began to remember. There on the floor beside him, the broken flecked. Oh, gods, Thonius mumbled. Stupid, stupid, stupid. He pulled himself to his feet. His skin was goose-flesh, his clothes cold and lank with sweat. He tried not to think of the things he'd witnessed in that moment. Stupid, stupid! Bad trip, he said out loud in a shaky voice.
That's all it was. Bad trip. Your own stupid fault.
He bent down and collected up the pieces of the broken flecked, wrapped them in the tissue paper, and hid them in his luggage. Suddenly, he snapped round. How long had he been out? He looked at the chron on his desk. An hour. He'd lost an entire hour, at least. Something cried out and made him jump. For a second, he thought it was the lamenting moan that had called out to him as he'd fallen into the pit, and there was no pit. No darkness, no moaning. He breathed hard to control his panic. That had all been a dream, just a spasm in his mind. Everything was okay. The cry came again, from along the hall.
Shit, Carl said. Sko!
Thonius unlocked the door and looked in. Sko sat on the chair, staring at him.
About time, he said. I've been calling. Calling for ages.
Well, I'm here now. What's the problem?
Sko raised his manacled hands.
Same as usual. Cramps.
I thought the doctor gave you a liniment, said Carl.
For my skin, not the cramps, said Sko.
All right.
Carl walked into the room until he was just beyond the reach of the floor chain.
You know the drill. Show me.
Sko raised his hands to show that both of the heavy steel manacles were locked tight around his wrists. Carl took the key from his pocket and tossed it to Sko. The hunter caught it, undid his cuffs, and began to rub his wrists.
That's enough, said Carl.
Give me a minute,
Sko replied, flexing his aching joints.
Now, said Carl.
With a glare, Sko locked the manacles back in place again. He tossed the key back to Carl.
Show me.
What the hell's wrong with your nose? Sko asked.
What?
You're bleeding,
Sko said, nodding his head at Thonius. Carl felt at his face, saw the red on his fingertips.
Damn it,
he said, and went out, slamming the door and locking it. He hurried to the hall mirror. His nose was bleeding freely, and his eyes were hideously bloodshot.
Oh, Throne,
he whispered. Fever Sko waited a few seconds, then slipped his hands out of the cuffs. He had relocked them loose, but even so it skinned his knuckles pulling them off. The doctor's greasy liniment helped. Without that lubrication. He went to the door, knowing it was locked. No time for caution now. This was the chance, the fleeting chance. Sko was a strong man, and desperation made him stronger. One kick smashed the door out of its frame. Carl turned at the crash. Sko was already moving, charging him like a bull. The hunter body slammed into Carl and drove him back into the wall, shattering the mirror. Carl tried to fight Sko off, but the other man was much more powerful. He slammed Carl into the wall again, then punched him in the face. Carl flew backwards, hit the jamb of the doorway opposite, and fell to the floor, unconscious. Sko thought for a second about finishing the job. It would be a pleasure to kill the bastard interrogator, but he knew there wasn't time. If the others were about, they'd have heard all this. He ran for the stairs, flying down them. In pajama pants and a singlet, Kara emerged from her room.
Carl, what the hell's going...
She saw Sko leaping down the staircase.
Damn it, no!
She yelled, and ran after him, ignoring the pain in her belly. Sko had a good lead. He was in the hall before she was even halfway down the stairs. Seeing her, he turned and hurled a hall chair at her. She ducked, and it broke against the heavy banister. Sko was at the front door, throwing the deadbolts, and then he was out, onto the path, into the cold grey evening. Barefoot, in agony, Kara pursued him. Onto the street, the wide, quiet avenue. No traffic, no pedestrians. Just the high, ivy-clad walls of the neighbouring mansions, street lamps, alarm posts. Even hurt, she was fast. Sprinting furiously, she began to close the distance on the fleeing man. He couldn't escape. He simply couldn't. It would blow everything. They reached the street corner. Kara was close enough to grab him now, but as she clawed out, her foot slipped on wet leaves, and she fell sideways against a wall. Kara howled. Something had torn. Belknap's perfect stitching, probably. She tried to rise, but she couldn't. The pain was awful. Blood was soaking the front of her singlet. Sko was disappearing down the street. Carl Thonius leapt past her. Still running, he looked back. His face was a bloody mess.
Get back!
he yelled. "Get back and secure the house. Call the others. Gull, do it. I'll get Sko."
One hand on the wall, the other wrapped around her belly, Kara hobbled slowly back towards Miseramus. As per his habit, Dirsk Rickens got off the rail transit a stop early and walked the last 2 kilometers to his home. He'd done it for years, mainly to ensure he maintained a modicum of exercise in his life. But he also liked the surface-level streets of Formal E at night. The busy cafes, the dining houses, the music halls along the Griselda Wall. It was dark now. The city lit up with yellow lamps, and there was a threat of rain in the air. Even so, he waved off the boy gampers who approached him as he came down Eiselstack Underwalk and limped up the steps onto the ironwork footbridge over the yawning hydroelectric canyon. There was no one on the bridge. A few spots of rain struck against the bridge's tint-glass roof. A cold night wind, scented with nitric acid, blew in through the sides of the bridge's open framework. Rickens tapped his cane along the bridge deck. A figure appeared at the far end of the bridge and started to walk to meet him. The man was lean, well-dressed, and smoked a low stick in a long holder. His eyes, in the yellow cast of the street lanterns, seemed colourless. Rickens had been on the force long enough to be wary. His left hand closed on the snub he carried in his coat pocket. A mugging. Now that would be a perfect end to this particularly crappy day. Though the man looked too well-dressed to be a mugger. Not the usual moody vermin. Walking, they came close, almost eye to eye, then passed each other. Rickens relaxed slightly. False alarm. The man suddenly stopped and turned. He called out, "Excuse me, sir." Rickens halted and turned back.
"Yes?"
The man was coming back to him, his expression one of curiosity.
"Dirsk Rickens, am I right?"
Rickens stiffened.
"Well, this is more than chance. In a hive this size, a random meeting on an empty bridge, with someone who knows my name."
"I suppose so," said the stranger. "Nice to see the old instincts are still there. And thank you for confirming that your name is Dirsk Rickens."
"I'm not smiling, son,"
said Rickens, sliding the safety off the weapon in his pocket.
"Who sent you? Sankles?"
"He put in a call, but he doesn't have that kind of clout."
"Not even nearly. Only one man in this hive gives orders to the secretists."
Rickens sniggered.
"Well, that's the stupidest name I've heard in a while. What, am I supposed to be afraid?"
"Your choice," said Taurus Revoke.
"Relax, son,"
Rickens said.
"I know what this is. A little scare tactic to make me change my mind and resign after all. I've been expecting it. Let's get it over with. Make your threats. Hit me, if you intend to. I imagine your boss will want you to do that, and I don't want you to get into trouble. I just want to get home. So come on."
Revoke smiled.
"You think I'm here to put the frighteners on you? Dish out some intimidation to get you to be nice and play along? Something like that?"
"Sorry. That moment's long past." Revoke clicked his fingers. Rickens heard a humming sound behind him. He turned. At the far end of the bridge, silhouetted against the lamplight, a tall, hunched man with long, straggly hair was spinning what looked like a bull roarer.
"All right,"
Rickens said.
"If this is how you want it."
He pulled the gun and raised it, but the man with yellow eyes had vanished. Rickens turned, aiming his weapon at the other figure, and advanced towards him. That damned thing in the man's hand was still circling and humming.
"Magistratum,"
Rickens cried out.
"Drop that and assume the position. This is your first and only warning."
There was a sound, suddenly, like metal whisks churning milk. For a second, Rickens thought the rain had begun. He glanced around. Wings beating. The sheen birds mobbed in through the open side of the bridge frame. Hundreds of them, chrome and steel and silver, like a snowstorm fury driven by the wind. Rickens cried out. He fired once, twice, three times, his gun flash lighting the dark and glittering off the swirling metal wings of the flock. Then the unkindness enveloped him, jabbing and pecking, and he staggered backwards. The force of them drove him back over the rail. As Rickens fell into the vast hydroelectric canyon, he was already dead. His skin flayed off. Drax stopped swinging the lure. Taurus Revoke came out of the shadows, picked up the steel-shod walking cane, and threw it off the bridge into the night. Chapter 18 Sko vaulted the wall at the end of Parnassus and dropped onto the metal walkway. He found the stairwell and thundered downstack towards the arterial. Carl Thonius was about 20 paces behind him. They were moving through pedestrians now, thickets of citizens, tradesmen and gampers, who leapt aside and turned to stare at the two racing men. Carl could hear the noise of the traffic from the four-lane arterial. He knew Sko was blocked. There was a crossbridge for 9 stacks. Sko could either go along or down again, into the sinks. Carl saw Sko up ahead, slamming through the crowd, knocking people down. He was heading towards the lower pavements. Carl wasn't entirely sure how he was managing to keep up with the hunter. Lactic acid burned in his muscles, and his face hurt like hell. He realized it was simple. He absolutely didn't want to let Ravenna down. Sko couldn't be allowed to get away. He couldn't be allowed to contact his co-conspirators. It was a mortal lock. Carl simply had to catch him and stop him. If only he brought a weapon, the Hecate Six would have made this so much simpler. Carl lost sight of Sko. The man had ducked left into a crosswalk between 2 interlocked stacked towers. Carl followed and slewed to a halt. The crosswalk was empty. Where the hell had Sko go? Fever Sko, equally weary, was tired of running. He came out of the shadows like a pouncing carnadon. But Carl Thonius was caught up in a rush now. He turned, met the attack, and drove his fist into Sko's nose. The hunter reeled away, then lunged back with a potentially back-breaking punch that Carl sidestepped. Carl was a slight, slender man, but he was quick, and he had been trained by the Inquisition's best. You didn't make Interrogator without learning certain skills. The fact that Carl Thonius avoided physical combat didn't mean he wasn't capable of it. The fight lasted 10 seconds. In that brief time, the two men traded almost 50 strikes and counter-strikes, whip-snake fast, the precise martial skills of the thrown agent pitted against the brute force and cunning of a game-hunter who had survived the dangers of countless bar-fights and rip-worlds. Passers-by from the main street gawped at what they saw occurring down the alleyway. 2 men, blurs, engaged in a level of physical war that was seldom seen, even in a city that boasted the carnivora. Every punch, every kick was a potential killer. Every block, every smash, bone-breaking. Carl dodged, cracked Sko's ribs with an underpunch, then chopped wide at his exposed neck, but Sko lurched aside, caught the chopping hand, and viced to snap it. Carl had to somersault out of the hold and kicked out Sko's right leg from behind as he landed. Sko stumbled, but turned the fall into a sweep with his feet that Carl was forced to leap over. Sko came up, broke Carl's nose for the 2nd time that night, and crushed his left ear. But Carl blocked the 3rd punch, broke another of Sko's ribs with a sidekick, and burst Sko's right eye with a hammer claw. Sko staggered backwards. Carl leapt at him, but had underestimated the hunter's burning resolve. Sko threw a punch that hit Carl in the throat and dropped him onto his knees, choking. Sko started to run again. The crosswalk went nowhere except the fence overlooking the roaring arterial highway. Sko scaled the fence, shivering the chain link, kicking off Carl's hands as they tried to grab his ankles. He went over the fence top and fell onto one of the box girders over the rushing traffic 10 meters below. He clawed up and began to tightrope along the girder, arms out. Carl followed him, sliding over the chain link and down onto the narrow footing of the girder. It was so narrow, barely the width of his feet placed side by side. Vast transporters and cargo trucks roared by below them. Sko saw Carl coming after him. He looked down at the racing traffic of the arterial, all 4 speeding lanes, and jumped.
"Holy throne!" Carl cried.
Whether by luck or judgment, Sko landed on the top of a Cargo 10's freight container. He grabbed onto the netting before the slipstream dragged him off. Carl jumped too. The impact of landing punched the breath out of him, but he managed to stay on top of a parcel transporter 4 vehicles behind Sko's ride. Everything shook. The wind was in his face. Road sign displays whipped overhead, brightly lit and dangerously close. Carl clambered up, dragged himself forward. In disbelief, he watched as Sko jumped from the Cargo 10 onto the back of a lowrider truck that was busy overtaking it. Carl got up and threw himself into space, slamming down on the roof of a transit omnibus in the outside lane. The roof was flat metal, and Carl almost slithered right off until he got hold of the sill of the roof light. Up ahead, there was Sko, getting up and looking back. He saw Carl. "Bastard!" Carl stuttered, trying to hold on. The thundering traffic suddenly slowed down so violently that Carl was thrown flat again. The overhead alerts announced an accident at Whitney Circus. Abruptly, they were almost at a standstill. Carl got up, leapt off the omnibus and onto the roof of a small private transport, denting it. He heard cries of complaint. Sko was moving too, off the lowrider onto a crawling cargo 8, and off that straight onto a limousine. Carl followed, jumping from one slow-moving vehicle to the next, ignoring the protests of the drivers and the blaring horns. He almost missed his footing leaping for a cargo 10, almost went under its wheels. Almost. Sko bounced off the roof of a sedan and rode the windscreen down onto the bonnet. The vehicle braked hard, and the van behind rear-ended it with a brutal shunt. Horns blasted again. From where Carl was, it looked as if Sko had been thrown off onto the highway. But no, there he was, climbing the revetment on the far side of the arterial. Carl threw himself into the air, rolled as he crunched onto the roof of a cab, and got up. Another vault got him onto the back end of a cargo 8, and then he was at the revetment, clambering up the wall after Sko. Carl was in a frenzy, not even thinking. He was finding strength from somewhere, somewhere deep inside him. It was an ugly strength, a dark, unpleasant force. But Carl Thonius didn't even stop to think about that. Below him, the traffic had begun to speed up again, engines racing. Carl scraped his way to the top of the 6-meter revetment. He looked up. Sko was standing over him on the top of the wall, looking down, one eye a bloody gouge. Sko grinned and stamped on Carl's hands. Yelling out, Carl lost his grip and plunged down into the speeding traffic. Sko jumped down off the revetment and limped along an unlit walkway, gasping for breath. There were streetlights ahead. He could see that with his remaining eye, and that meant a cab or a transit station, maybe even a public vox post. Dazed, he tried to think. Akunin. How could he contact Akunin? Maybe the circus was the best bet, or perhaps he should go straight to the top. The ministry would protect him surely, given what he knew. Trice owed him. He limped on. A man came out of the shadows ahead of him. The man was smiling. The man was Carl Thonius.
"How the hell did you..."
Sko began.
"Truth be told, I don't really know,"
Carl replied. Only it wasn't his voice. It was a dry, rasping growl. Sko backed away. Carl's eyes were glowing red from the inside, as if a lamp had been lit inside his skull.
"Holy of holies," Sko mumbled, backing away. "What are you?" "I'm not sure yet,"
the rasping voice replied, gusting like rotten air from Carl's lips. The inner light had increased, shining out of Carl Thonius's nostrils, mouth, eyes, and glowing through the skin of his face so that the shadows of the skull formations inside were visible like an X-ray plate.
"But I know what you are," he said.
Carl raised his right hand. The flesh peeled back from the bones like melting wax, and the exposed finger bones extended into talons, long and thin and curved.
"What you are is dead,"
Carl rasped. Chapter 19. We were leaving Strikeson's mansion when the vox chimed. We'd been in there a few hours, probing him for everything he knew. Behind us, we left a man who had no idea what secrets he had just revealed. As far as Athan Strikeson and his entire staff were concerned, he'd just had a nasty visit from the tax office. "Yes," I answered. "We need you here," Frauke replied. Through Mathewin's eyes, I looked at Kiss and Nail. "Got to go. Get back safe." They nodded. As soon as I had left him, they led the slightly woozy Mathewin up the hill to the rented flyer parked behind the trees. "What happened?" I asked, resuming control of my chair. "There was an incident," Frauke replied lightly. "I'd taken the boy to a gallery, like you suggested. An exhibit of the later remembrances. Quite beautiful work, if a little..."
"Whiston, the point,"
he shrugged. "We got back. Sko had escaped."
"How?"
It seems Dr. Belknap's liniment afforded him the opportunity to slip his cuffs. He overpowered Carl. Kara went after him, but she hurt herself. Is she all right? Belknap's with her now. Carl continued the pursuit. It would appear he killed Sko. I swung my chair around. Look after Zale, please. Distract him. All right, Frauke answered. How did it go with Strikeson? Fine. The others are on their way back now. I'll fill in the details later. I floated down the hall and entered the front lounge. Carl was sitting there on an armchair, gazing into space. I tried briefly to read him, but his mind was impenetrable. Shock, I supposed. Carl, what happened?
Sko got out, sir,
he said, getting to his feet. His face was split and bruised. His clothes were torn and soaked with blood.
I gave chase. I knew we couldn't let him get away.
That would have been bad, I conceded. So, you killed him? He looked at me sharply.
No. No, no. I didn't. I chased him. We fought. He tried to climb the fence beside the arterial. And he fell. Went under the wheels of a cargo 10. It was instantaneous.
I sighed. Better that, I suppose, I began. Better that than he'd got away. Are you all right?
A little dinged up. That happens, right?
Yes. Go and get yourself cleaned up, Carl. Get Belknap to look at your face. He nodded.
What happens next?
He asked me. We know what they're doing. We just don't know why. As of tomorrow, we switch to infiltration. Kiss and Harlan will be going in to find out what this is actually about.
What they want the data engines for?
Exactly, Carl. Exactly that.
I see,
he said. He paused.
About Sko. I'm really sorry.
Don't be, I said. Our cover's still intact. That's the main thing. If our enemy had found out we were still alive and operating here, infiltration would be suicide. Thanks to you, we're still covert. You should feel good about yourself.
I do,
he said. Fine, I replied. As long as we're still invisible, we can do this. In his private suite at the Petropolitan, Shipmaster Akunin put down his glass and sat back, listening to the neotropical songbugs chirruping in their cages. Akunin was a short, bulky man with a crown of white hair around his bald pate. He wore black robes with red buttons, traces of digita inlay spread across his jaw. An aide entered the room.
Well? Akunin asked.
It seems that whatever happened this afternoon at Master Strikeson's house was a false alarm.
Really?
I'm waiting for details, but it seems he was visited by the tariff revenue. A legitimate visit.
Akunin sipped his drink.
They shouldn't be investigating him. Trice assured us that our cartel would be immune from...
He looked at his aide.
Yet more grounds for complaint. After Chaikov, this petty insolence. Send to Trice. Repeat that I need to see him personally. Insist, please. I won't be brushed off any more. This is getting out of hand.
The aide nodded.
Also, sir, there is a Master Siskind here to see you.
Akunin rose.
Let him in.
Bartol Siskind walked into the grand apartment, glancing around. With his shaggy red hair and glass jacket, he looked out of place and uncomfortable amongst the trappings of high living.
Siskind, Akunin said, offering a hand. This is unexpected.
Siskind took the hand.
Master, thank you for seeing me.
Will you sit?
Thank you.
I had thought to see you at the Reach last year. Your cousin suggested you might be ready to join with us.
I was delayed, unavoidably.
But you are here now.
Indeed,
said Siskind.
Master Akunin, when did you last hear from my cousin? Master Thekla?
Not since Firetide, Akunin said. He was conducting a little business for us there at Bonner's Reach. I imagine he'll be lying low for a while, though I expect him to join me here in the next few weeks. He backs your interests, you know. He's very keen for you to join the cartel.
So am I, said Siskind.
Akunin